certainly there is no hotter topic among folk in the media right now than ethanol. And certainly the mainstream media is beginning to catch up to what us in agricultural reporting knew for some time, and that is the stunning demand curve and growth curve of this industry, particularly in the last 3 years. And so what we thought we would do first to sort of get us all on the same page from a baseline is kind of discuss where ethanol was and where it is now. We'll get to the future and down the road in just a few minutes, but kind of just set the stage, if you will, for ethanol. And to do that, we asked Mary Holmes, who's the relationship manager for Agribusiness Solutions out of Peoria, Illinois. Mary, that's a new job for you, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it's a new job. And she did some other things a little bit western part of the state, and she'll share what she did there as well. But Mary, would you catch us up on where we are currently in terms of ethanol plants, production, how it has grown in the last few years? Get us all on the same page.
Well, I'll try, but I don't know that I can do that without help from my cohorts up here. Just to give you a little brief background, Randall Matheny to my left here and Clarence Shuddy out in the audience asked me when I was finishing up my past position the end of January if I'd come over to Covington, Indiana and sit on an ethanol panel with them. And I said, did you guys not hear? I just told you I quit my job. Well, yeah, we heard, so can you come? So anyway, in my past position, I was the manager of the Illinois Value-Added Rural Development Center at Western Illinois University in Macomb. And so I've been in on the ground floor to help organize some of these farmer-owned ethanol projects and have had the opportunity to work with the Lincoln Land Agri-Energy Group, the Big River Resource Group, the Illini Bioenergy Project in Lincoln, in the Lincoln area, and several others throughout Illinois. And so from my side of things and from what I think that the three of us up here are going to tell you a lot about today is that, you know, we see the opportunity for farmers and local residents to invest in opportunities as a great opportunity to spur rural economic growth in small towns in Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, throughout the Midwest. However, I don't think it's any secret that that the big guys are getting in the game now. And so just to give you a little background, we started about, 1999, working on these two particular projects. We were working on ethanol projects when it wasn't cool. I went back to the university and told my boss, oh, guess what this group of ag producers and economic development professionals want to do? They want to build an ethanol plant in Crawford County. And he said, well, you guys are nuts. I don't really want you to be involved in that. Went to my one of my bosses at the University of Illinois, told him the same story. He told us we were nuts. He didn't think that was a very good idea. Some folks in Bloomington said, you know, if you guys want to invest in ethanol, you probably ought to buy some ADM stock. But there's nothing that when you get a bunch of bullheaded farmers together can't be done. But from my perspective, when you think about how long it's taken us to get the RFS passed, and I just thought I'd get you all on the same page talking about that. You know, the goal of the renewable fuel standard really is to help spur rural economic development from coast to coast. And when you put that in terms of what that can do for us, at the very minimum, it will spark $6 billion in new investment to build 4.3 billion gallon of new ethanol capacity in the nation. It will add nearly $2 billion to our GDP. It'll generate an additional $43 billion of household income for all Americans. It'll create more than 230,000 new jobs in all sectors of the economy and displace over 2 billion barrels of crude oil. But if you listen to this, what I'm saying is this is what it's going to do for all of us. But I think from our perspective in Illinois, your perspective in Indiana, whether we're talking about Iowa, Ohio, or wherever, you know, this is going to affect all of us. But I think what we're here to tell you about is our story and how to get local folks involved. And Ray's got a great story along those lines that he'll share with you later. But it's very true. There's very, very minimal opportunity for local farmers and local residents to invest in these ethanol plants because, in fact, the big guys really have woken up and they really are investing in this. And I think we heard that from Greg Johnson a few minutes ago when he talked about Anderson's and how they were getting involved in ethanol. So my question for you is, how many of you in this room are currently ethanol producers? Well, if you're farmers and you're raising corn, you're an ethanol producer because that's where the corn flow is heading.
Well, Mary, let's just check to see how many people are raising corn.
But you have to put that in terms of think. It's not just about raising corn now. Now you're raising ethanol. So that's sort of where I come from and my background.
Thank you, Mary. And to my immediate right, your left, as you're looking at the stage, is Randall Matheny. And Randall has been on the ground floor as a farmer of an ethanol plant development at Lincoln Land over in Palestine, Illinois, down south of here. He's farmed since 1968, corn, beans, beef cattle. And as I said, he's a board member on the Lincoln Land Co-op. He's also the director and treasurer of Lincoln Land. And, Randall, I bet you have some interesting stories to tell about how you start from the ground up as a farmer and put in an ethanol facility.
Well, excuse me. Back in about 2000, I heard about a meeting that they'd had the week prior to, and Clarence Shuddy's on the board down there, and he'd contacted Mary and got some people together, and I think at the first meeting I was at, I think it was like 12 people there. We continued to grow, and I think we're up to 450-some-odd members now in the Lincoln Land Co-op. But back in 2000, we kind of had a dream, sell pie in the sky, and go out and decide to build an ethanol plant. And it took a lot of help from a lot of people, and we just sat around and kicked it around one day and figured probably there was about 10,000 hours donated to get this plant to the construction stage. And that's getting permits, equity drives, getting your infrastructure in and everything. But it was enjoyable. But the thing is, if you're going to control your destiny, you got to get involved and do it.
So how do you do that?
Well, it was a challenge at times, but it took a lot of hard work of a lot of people getting the right folks in place just taking off and hard work.
All the way down at the far end of the table is Raymond Deffenbaugh, and he also got in on the ground floor of an ethanol facility over at Big River, that at West Burlington, Iowa, and he's currently participating in the development of several very large ethanol facilities in the 100 million gallon plant area, one in Illinois and another in Iowa, and he's working with plants in Adams County, Illinois, Lyle, Iowa, and he's also doing biodiesel as well, a plant in Iowa. Of course, he came on the panel willingly because he regularly goes around promoting and helping in the development of the ethanol and biofuel industry. A Southern Saluki graduate, right, Ray?
That's correct.
Saluki, a bachelor's in science and agriculture education, a master's in science and agriculture economics. And Ray, I guess I want to begin the first thing I want you to comment on is, and we've already heard it a little bit from the, as we heard from the Andersons building three ethanol facilities. If you look down the list of ethanol facilities in the U.S., you'll see that Archer Daniels Midland by far has more facilities than any other group of people who are working on ethanol. And the question I have for you is, how open is the window for local producers at this time, and how quickly might it close if they don't act rather quickly?
Well, that's an interesting question. Before I answer it, I might tell you a mention was made earlier of Darrell Good. He and I shared a desk together in graduate school, and we both might have amounted to something if we hadn't tried to prove the other didn't know how to play chess. And that's what life is about. That's what farming is about. It's a game of strategy. I'd like to ask a question here. I ask people that come to our plant from the East Coast to the West Coast, of your cornfields, how many of them guard them with a gun? No hand.
Nobody's guarding it with a gun today.
You realize there's over 500 gallons of ethanol out on each acre of that. Now, the fuel over in Iraq, how many is guarded with a gun? So think about that a little bit and what part you play in the balance of trade of our nation and defense and so forth. And I think it's a very important role as producers, both corn and soybeans. But the question is the window still open? And, yes, I think it is. There's a lot of people that think that the days of the co-op are over, and one of the reasons they say that is because of the size of the plant that's required. Used to be we would build plants that were 40 million, maybe. I think when we built ours, a 40 million was considered, there wasn't any 40 million, actually. And we were asking people to invest outside their realm of comfortability, machinery, farmland, and so forth. We were asking them to invest in something that had never been done before. Now, in building plants, 40 millions aren't discussed very often. They're talking 50 or 60s at the minimum, and the most efficient plants are hundreds that will crank out 110. A few of them are talking even more, million gallons per year. You're talking for a 50 or 60 about $85 million. For 100, 110, you're talking about $135 to $143 million. Now, I came a long ways to come to this meeting, and if I had calculated out the mileage and economy of my car to get here, put in just enough fuel to reach here and run into a headwind or some traffic snarls or whatever, I wouldn't have made it. And that's what capital plays to an ethanol facility. If you don't have enough capital, it's like if you're on an ocean liner and you fall off that ocean liner and you're down there floundering around yelling for help. Somebody throws you a life jacket, and you get that close to the life jacket and drown, you're just as dead as if you missed it by a mile. So you have to have lots of capital. And some will build plants for 40%. We built ours on 54%. And when this turns around, whether it's 4, 5, or 6 years down the road, that capital is what will carry you through. And so that's one of the problems with the co-ops. If 100 is now the type of and size of plant that some think need to be built, then can you raise that in the capital in the co-op structure? Now, some of them are doing LLC public offerings and LLC private offerings. And I have a close friend that we've worked for, and I have personally invested in it, that they just opened up Absolute Energy in northern Iowa. And in one day, they raised $63 million. $63 million for a 100-million-gallon plant. That's enough to build a plant. 450 people showed up at the first meeting, and they've got like a full series of meetings scheduled throughout March and April that they're going to have to cancel, and they're going to have to send some of the money back. Now, that's the feeding frenzy that we have right now in the ethanol industry. Can that be accomplished in the co-op basis? I still think the co-op is still a good structure. We're utilizing it as a joint venture in our West Burlington plant. And there aren't too many doing it, but if it's not the co-op structure, then private placement or public offering is the other alternative. But there is still opportunity. The window is still available, but it's squeezing shut. Hopefully that answers your question.
It does. In 2005, roughly 1.43 billion bushels of corn were used for ethanol production. That's roughly 13% of the total U.S. corn crop, and it was a pretty large one at that. The question I have for you is, given the stunning growth of the ethanol curve, how does this, over time, impact our corn market? Will more corn stay domestically, for example? Will there be parts of the country which become corn deprived over time? I'm interested in what the forces on corn will be. Who would like that question?
I guess I would relate to our story. When we built in southeast Iowa, I happen to live in Illinois, and I do farm north of here in the Pontiac area, so I'm a little bit diverse, and I guess I would say people said at that time that why would you build in southeast Iowa? If you remember, Producers Alliance was going around throughout the state. I think they may have even come into Indiana looking to build the Lakota plant. And high-priced corn in southeast Iowa, we set along the river. And why would we want to build there? My reply was, because when you use up both farmers and his farm dog, where are you going to go for capital? Plus, you're a long ways from anywhere in getting your ethanol out and your products that are needing your enzymes and so forth in. It turns out setting on that river was a tremendous advantage. It's allowed us to ship our co-product all over the world from Korea, South America, Central America. Tremendous advantage there. We have the Chicago markets and the St. Louis markets that we can rely on. So what looked like, and by industry standards, was a very bad move turned out to be an exceptionally good move. And the question is, what about that corn basis? And I think that's what you're asking. I would kind of vary a little bit from discussions earlier in that as these ethanol plants come in, I look for, at the most, a dime's difference, and probably there may not be a nickel's worth of difference between, say, this area and western Iowa. Right now, there's a whole lot more than that. But right now, the ethanol plants, if you look at what's in Iowa right now, if you draw a line from the northeast corner to the southwest corner, there's a whole lot of plants up there, and there's not a lot of extra corn. And that demand is going to change that basis dramatically. We're a member of several of the elevator associations, as well as the corn growers and the feed and grain association. And you don't go to a meeting that you don't think you're at an ethanol meeting, rather than the meeting that you're attending, because it's having a dramatic effect on the markets and that basis. We can see it in our community, and we can see it in other communities. Generally speaking, an ethanol plant will raise a 40 or 50 million gallon ethanol plant is projected to raise the basis 5 to 6 cents and probably 13 cents on a 100 million gallon plant. Whether that happens or not, it depends on whether they need the corn, and you can't compete with an ethanol plant or any processor if they need the corn. The best practice is to sell ahead, because when they got their needs met, they don't have a bid. So I think you got that advice from several of the panel this morning on selling ahead, and there's some real good markets out there, especially with an ethanol plant.
Well, let's put it where the rubber hits the road and go to Randall and ask him what the actual experience at Lincoln Land has been regarding basis both pre- and post-ethanol production.
Well, we're one of two farmer-owned plants, and we're the farthest southeast in Illinois. And we're not in the situation they are in Iowa, where if you draw a circle, they all start overlapping. There is a plant over in Indiana about 50 miles southeast of us, but we have a little competition from them, but they're not going to drive by when they're, you know, for the fuel prices and everything. They've got to bid up to get the corn out of our area. So right now we're in good shape, and it's probably raised it somewhere between 7 and 10 cents.
One of the things that about the basis here that puzzles me a little bit is, and I heard you say a dime, and that seems to make sense. But I also hear that from this morning, the Andersons getting involved in the ethanol business. Well, they are primarily an elevator. And as I look down the list of plants that have have been built, there seems to be a number of elevators among them. And I'm just wondering, is it possible, Mary, that all we're seeing here, when it all comes to fruition and the renewable fuel standard is completely met, that we're just seeing a different set of, the same set of owners getting the corn a different way?
Well, I think there's certainly potential for that. I've got a project in central Illinois that's a group of six co-op elevators putting together a 100-million-gallon ethanol project. Their anticipation is that their farmers will be able to invest in that project, and that's good. But once again, you know, where is the benefit to the farmer if we put all of these ethanol plants, you know, in a location, and it might bump up your basis a little bit, but I think we could see that from the Iowa standpoint. They put all those plants in Iowa, and they put them too close together because they could buy cheap corn. Well, guess what their corn costs are now? So we can bump up the basis and increase that, and that's good from the farmer's standpoint, but we do have to figure out how to do this strategically so that as producers we can get some value out of it.
I want to go to my good friend Todd Gleason, who tells me we have an update from the Chicago Board of Trade about where prices are.
Yeah, Dave, we've got the May corn down a half penny, September corn up a quarter penny, December corn up down a half penny at 259. Wheat's coming back, making new daily highs in Chicago. July wheat up 3 cents at 394.5. The bean complex is steady to down a half. The March beans steady. May beans down 1.25 at 599.25. November beans down a half at 622. Meal is up 40 to 80. Bean oil down 25 ticks.
Thank you very much, Mike Zuzolo of Risk Management, with the quotes there. You know, many states are considering or have put in legislation to capitalize on ethanol and renewable fuels in general. Minnesota, and maybe Minnesota might be considered the leader from a renewable fuels standard. They got a 20% ethanol requirement that takes effect in 2013, but it's on the books now. Also, Hawaii, Montana, Illinois, considering legislation we heard last week, the Senate voting in favor of some ethanol standards. The question I guess I want to explore with you is, to what degree do you believe that these ethanol standards will continue to drive the ethanol market? Because I have a few concerns, and one of them revolves around E85. If you look at where all the E85 gas stations are, they're primarily right here in the Midwest. There's about 650 of them or thereabouts, but there's something like 170,000 gas stations nationwide. So I'm wondering, if ethanol is really going to be a national player, what will it take to do that? Or are we now a national player? I guess you can take it either way. Who would like that? Mary?
I'd take a first stab at that. I would say that, yes, there's huge potential for ethanol to become a national player. The E85 issue is kind of like the chicken and the egg. We don't have enough E85 stations available. We don't have enough E85 vehicles available. So one of the things that both of these ethanol producers are doing is they're working to promote E85, figure out ways to get more E85 stations placed, and working with the car dealers and, you know, that industry in order to increase the E85 vehicles that are available. So there's several E85 stations up in the Chicago area, and I think that there's real potential for that.
E85 went over in our area last fall. There's a couple of stations opened up, and there was a price difference there, because you will take us a little bit of a hit on mileage. Today, that has come together, whether it's only about a dime cheaper than an E10 or your regular or your premium. I think the first thing they got to do is the car industry has to develop an engine where they won't take that hit on that mileage and do the 20% less or 15, whatever would be, and they can do it. But I think Big Oil has a little bit behind it right now, because they're not trying to push it. the price of gasoline should be, with E85, what they're buying it for, they should be 35, 40 cents difference, and they're not at the time. But I don't know if it'll be as big a player as the E10, because that there is a nationwide thing, and that's some big potential gallons.
We have a question out in the audience.
In Brazil at the present time, just the latest material I've read is that they use 41% ethanol right now. They have E85 all over the place. Who makes their vehicles? Why do they run on all this stuff when ours here supposedly won't? Aren't the same people making their vehicles? And why don't we have that?
I think similar. I just came out of quite a trip down in that area. I guess I don't view them as the enemy particularly. They did fill a niche when it was needed. The Model A Ford, Model T, it was made to run on ethanol, I have a car that's rather old that I burn E85 in, so a lot of it is the components that are in it. I think what Randall's talking about is the efficiency, maybe changing the compression ratio a little. It is not a very difficult thing, and a lot of that is just demand, so that demand is building. In 1970, I've been involved in banking as well for about 30 years, and when I was a graduate student, we used to have mainframe computers and the card, and you'd go wait your turn and punch the card through and let it grind out, and they come out with these little computers. I have seen some of them out here, and I went to the bank, and I says, you know, we ought to get one of these things. These are pretty nice, and they'll probably be useful. And the first computer that the bank owned, I had to buy. I still have it in the basement, and I'm hoping one day it'll be worth something as an antique. Now, the computer could do anything that you wanted it to do. There just weren't the programs that are out there. And that's about where we're at with the ethanol. We now have the renewable fuel standard, and it exposed the oil company to liability in using MTBE. So they're jumping off that ship like rats off a sinking ship. So that's really good for us. And I think getting those automobiles changed around a little bit, which is not difficult because they're doing it in Brazil now, is the next step in that process. And it'll be as common to use ethanol in the future and biodiesel as the computer is now. I saw all the hands go up on computers, and I'll bet there weren't very many hands would have gone up if that question had been asked in the 70s, but you didn't have the programs, and that's what we need for ethanol.
I think one thing that could hurt us on the E85 right now is the fact that the cars does not get that mileage. And Ford and Chevrolet, they've got a big campaign to live green with a yellow cap and so-and-so. But if people try it, and I'm not talking farm community, but I'm talking large cities, if they try it and they take a hit on it, then it's going to be hard to get them back to it.
We've heard the word Brazil a couple of times, and, of course, most of their ethanol is coming from sugar. It was heavily underwritten by the government in terms of its development, and maybe that's part of the reason that Brazil has the jump on the U.S. at the moment. After all, our renewable fuel standard is fairly new. But the question that I have is, do producers like Brazil see the U.S. as a potential market for their ethanol? I know that Brazil did ship some ethanol to the U.S. this past year, even though it had full duty on it. They still thought that it was worth doing and bringing to market here in the U.S. So I am wondering whether or not you believe that the market forces in place via duty and other kinds of things are enough to protect, at least in the short term, development of the U.S. ethanol market to full term.
One of the things that should be noted is you read and hear regularly of that duty or tariff or whatever it is, a 51 cents. That is a program put on by our government to benefit you folks, our ethanol industry and the farm industry. Brazil has its own benefits, and for them to be able to ship in here and utilize that 51 cents means they get benefited by both programs. So it's not necessarily a penalty. It's just equalizing that board a little bit. As far as the past, I think they've served a useful purpose when we were developing this industry. If we wouldn't have had the volume, probably 85-90% of our future is political. And if we wouldn't have had the volume, the political atmosphere would have changed dramatically. So they filled a niche when it was necessary. I think it's more difficult for them to compete now. I'm not really concerned about that problem. In Central America, when I was down there last week, the vice president of the country came up and he says, you know, our problem is with the sugarcane, what do we do with the co-product or the byproduct? And he had a lot of reasons that he should use sorghum instead of sugarcane. So, you know, it's kind of like when I was in banking, somebody was always afraid somebody else was making a little more than the other one and wanting to pull them back to their level. And I always said, kick them in the seat of the pants and drive them ahead, and they'll pull you along in the vacuum. So I'm not so concerned about Brazil. I think we've got our own industry to tend to, and I think we can do it very efficiently.
We have a question out in the audience.
Yeah, most of your plants run on natural gas, and we see what's happened to natural gas with the anhydrous. What do you think of a coal-fired ethanol plant?
Well, it adds a lot. First thing, it adds a lot of cost to the plant, and where our plant is setting, we're right setting on the edge of a town, and we feel right at the present time that we want to be a good neighbor, and hopefully that natural gas will come back down a little bit, but it's something you're going to have to look at. I know a lot of the new plants that's being talked about are talking coal, but it's adding a lot to the price, and it makes it hard to raise the money to get that plant built.
Randall, specifically, how does it add cost?
Well, it's just environmental issues, and I think last I heard, you're probably looking at probably 50 million to stick a coal-fired boiler on.
We've got an old saying down on the farm: "Be not the first for which the new is tried, nor the last to cast the old aside." So coal has great possibilities, but I would rather it was your neck in the noose than mine. Once you've proven it, then I'll follow. And you know. That having been said, there are those that are trying coal, and I think it will be perfected. There will be a few glitches along the way in utilizing the fluidized bed. It's a little unstable, but I think it'll be proven. In the meantime, you've got a whale of a lot of money tested out there, and you know what works. Probably right now, the consensus in the ethanol industry is that it's moving forward more rapidly in Iowa because of the pollution standards and the requirements in that area. And it's a little more difficult in Illinois, but it will come. One of the thoughts that is coming about is a lot of the transportation that brings that coal here, outside of using Illinois coal, is those freight rates are going up dramatically. So about the time you spend that $50 million, then your coal price goes up, and there might be some problems there. Am I a discourager of using coal? No, you should look at all avenues to be the most efficient producer, because as this industry consolidates, and if you think in terms of the bell curve, we're still on the left-hand side, downward end of that bell curve. When we get to the top, you want to be the most efficient producer. It's like the old gorilla story, or the old grizzly bear story, where the two guys are out in the camp, and there's a cub right outside their window, and the grizzly bear is 100 yards away, and the one fella is putting on his shoes, and the guy says, "What's wrong with you, man? Why aren't you running? Even a horse can't outrun a grizzly," and he says, "I don't have to outrun that grizzly." And so all he has to do is outrun the other guy and let him be grizzly bear bait. And that's what you need to be as farmers and ethanol producers.
Another question out in the audience.
Yes. Why not have an E40? Why do we have to jump from E10 up to E85 and then take a hit on mileage on it? I live in the Chicago area, and there's a few gas stations out in that area, but there's not that many E85 cars. Why can't we come into this a little more conservatively? And what about the basis on ethanol? And how about the transportation? Is it shipped by rail car? Or when you get into E85, for instance, you're going to have a change the transport. You know, do you run it through pipelines? Or how is that going to be worked out?
All right, we had three questions there. Mary, let's see if we can break them down here. First off, we have E40. Is that a good compromise between what we have now and E85?
Well, that's a really good question, and I'm all for E40. Do you want to lead the charge on that? Because Randall and Ray and Clarence and some of us are getting a little bit tired. But I'm not really certain why the E85. It's just been E85. I know that the E10, the 10% standard is, what is it, 20% in Minnesota?
Yeah.
And so we've talked about that a lot amongst, you know, the groups that we work with, is that, you know, is 10% enough? Well, we definitely don't think it's enough. I don't know if it's 40% or 30% or 50%, but we'd sure like you to come and help us do that.
And part two had something to do with transportation. How does this stuff get around? Randall, you take that.
Ours is all shipped out either by truck or rail. It's not really feasible to ship it by pipeline because ethanol will draw water. It absorbs water, and you want to ride as close as 200 proof as possible. That way you're not contaminating your fuel supply.
And a third question had something to do with the basis, but I didn't quite catch all of it. Did you catch what the basis part of that question was? They're nodding. They did.
Too many questions.
Well, get back to him and have him explain it to us.
Well, kind of like the cash basis on the grain or the corn. If you produce this in Iowa, what's it going to cost to get it out to where people can use it? You're not going to use all this ethanol around Iowa. It's going to be shipped to different locations, and you're going to have a transportation cost on it. And another thing I noticed, the price of E85 varies with price of regular petroleum gas. It doesn't seem to have any. I can't figure out what ethanol costs. Or you know, it seems like the gas station will sell it if gas goes up a dime or whatever. Ethanol goes up a dime or E85. But anyhow, getting back to the cash basis, when you have to ship that by truck or rail, you're going to run into some pretty serious transportation costs on this, and big time. Well, I think there's something's got to be solved in that area in order to get this used, you know, more, in order to increase use of ethanol.
Is he right? Is a bunch of this ethanol going to go interstate?
We're utilizing the Burlington Northern. I think a lot of the plants are going on the UP. We'll have a plant on the UP. Cinex is a good short line to go on to because it's a straight line into New York, and into New York, it's quicker and cheaper to get there by rail than it is by water right now. So, you know, I guess we're satisfied with the rail, but transportation is what adds to the cost. And right now, our best and biggest markets are Chicago and St. Louis, so we're trucking a large percentage of it. But we do send out a lot of rail. We're not sending out any barges. We know that being one of the few dry mills on the river that we will eventually, and there is a market out there, but we can achieve all of our goals by using the road, the truck, and the rail.
We have another question in the audience.
A moment ago, we were talking about how to fire the ethanol plant. How about firing them with corn?
Why not fire with corn? And I first started on ethanol in 92, and one of the things I was saying that a bushel of corn has more BTUs in it than a bushel of coal, and you ran into a lot of resistance with using food for fuel. I think more and more people are using that, but the fact remains it's more expensive, really, to utilize than natural gas, so that's the main reason.
More expensive.
Some do use the... Some use the syrup in a fluidized bed, and some are using other materials. Some are going on to dumps and pulling the gas off of those dumps. Pontiac, as you know, has got, what, the second largest dump in the world, so you can pull that gas off and decrease your cost quite a little bit.
Another question in the audience?
There's been a big clatter about waiving the oxygenation requirements. What's the possibility of this, and what's the results going to be if they get it done?
Mary?
Boy, I'm not really quite up to date on that. Ray might be a better person, but to really discuss that on more of a national level. But I would say that from the MTBE standpoint, you know, I don't see how we can even think about letting our waters become contaminated and continue to use that. So I think it's a matter of, to my mind, common sense that we've got to do away with it and come up with a better system. And I just think that ethanol is the answer to that.
Ray, oxygenization waived in California, I do believe.
Yeah, I think the demand's there, and the MTBE is on the skids, and they're going to use it, so that doesn't concern me.
Ethanol from cellulose, and that increases, you know, using corn stover or switchgrass, so you increase your yield of ethanol per acre with either one of those. You solve some of your energy problems then with, instead of coal or natural gas, you're burning some of the byproduct from that cellulosic process. How about ethanol from cellulose?
Yeah, and didn't the government say, let's try to build three facilities as pilots to see if we could get ethanol up and running in cellulosic fashion? In fact, but there is right now even one in Ottawa, Canada, already up and running. It's called the Iogen Corporation. I'd be interested in any of you know anything about that one in terms of its ethanol production as cellulosic.
Well, I'm familiar with the ability to do that. The fact is the starch that's in corn is a very efficient way. And I look out in the room here, and I know the statistics on the average farmer is he's in his late 50s. I know when I started farming with horses and loading hay by hand, that was the custom. We appreciated hard work. How many here want to go back to those days? Huh? No, you don't want to. So switchgrass, it's easy to haul a load of corn to an ethanol plant. How are you going to handle that switchgrass? How are you going to store it? How are you going to transport it? And so they will figure it out. I'm not saying that it won't happen. Someday they'll probably develop individual plants in local communities that will fluidize it, and then it'll go. It's just not there right now, and corn is the most efficient way to handle starch, and that's what you're doing here. It might be in other areas, but you live in this community, and this is where you grow your corn and beans. So and I think it's coming, but I don't think it's here
now. The bigger
now.
Question is, how many of you farmers out there are willing to convert and quit growing corn and start growing switchgrass? Please raise your hand now.
I don't see any hands raised for the big switchgrass plant.
Well, how many want to work like they did at 17 and 18? That's the big question. If you could, how many would? Nobody wants to go back to those days.
One thing about it, we could put people back to work if we did, because they'd have to go back to start building balers and stackers.
Well, and at 58 or 60 years old, how many want to put the capital investment in for the last 5 or 6 years of your work that's going to be required to grow that? Those are important questions. It doesn't mean it won't happen. It just means those are the obstacles that have to be overcome.
Is there enough land here in the U.S. for switchgrass cellulosic production? I mean, that was one of the big things that I read when the president made his announcement from people who were opposing it. They were saying, well, you need a whole lot more land than we got. You got to go down to Brazil and those kind of places where they can grow that.
Well, I think we've got plenty of land. I just don't know that we've got – doesn't seem to me that we've got producers that are willing to grow the switchgrass. And I know I've been working on a new crop research project at Western trying to convince farmers to grow milkweed, and I can tell you about how successful that's been. I spent 20 years of my life in production agriculture, beating it, cutting it, pulling it, spraying it, trying to get rid of it. And farmers don't convert to new crops as easily as maybe we would like for them to.
But it's mighty fine in a pillow.
Exactly. It's great.
Question.
Yeah, how are the co-op-owned small plants gonna hack it with the big money that's coming in for the huge plants?
Randall, I bet that's been a topic of discussion your way.
Well, Our goal down there is to get that plant paid down, get it where we can manage it, not to be extended. And, like Ray said earlier, you know, you got to do what you can do. But just don't get your neck stuck out too far and get it chopped off.
Clarence, I'd like to tell you a story on that. How many minutes do we have left? None?
Well, we have time for a story.
Well,
if it's a good one.
It's a good one, and probably permitted. I'll probably alienate a few people out there, and I don't intend to. When you talk about elevators that are involved, the purpose of an ethanol plant is community development, investment, retain your youth, and maintain your infrastructure. And a lot of our plants, we're working with elevators. Elevators are set up for drying and storage and handling, and they should work hand in hand. How many here have had anybody that has had cancer? Yeah, almost everybody has. And if a doctor treats for something other than that melody, it'll metastasize and either get you or get your friend. And the question is, what's that got to do with what we're talking about? It's recognizing the enemy and attacking it early. And the problem here, the enemy, is economics. How do we improve our lot? And you'll shoulder arms with anybody to attack a common enemy. Now, as far as the small plants, the story I want to share with you is that the world is made up of monkeys and gorillas. And the monkey and the gorilla survives off the fruit of the same tree. Now, the gorilla is not necessarily a bad person. They're not morally wrong. They're kind of good, really, because they keep the lions away from the monkeys. But the gorilla is kind of selfish in a way because he keeps only the good fruit, which is the upper fruit, for himself. Now, when the sun shines, such as it is now, in the tall grass, the monkey sleeps, or the gorilla sleeps, and the monkey climbs higher in the tree, getting bolder and bolder and chattering back and forth and attracting more monkeys and saying, "I didn't realize this fruit could be so good." And as he gets to the top, he says, "Good golly, I just didn't realize it was out there all this time." And the chatter awakens the gorilla. And he gets really mad. He looks over at the tree and he sees a monkey eating his fruit, what he perceives as his fruit. And he goes over to the tree and with a loud roar, he grabs it by the base and he shakes it very hard. And the weak monkey falls out immediately. With another loud roar, the gorilla swipes him and fur flies everywhere. And the monkey says, "I'll never do this again. This is too dangerous." But the strong monkey, he stays in that tree and he says, "No. God didn't create this good fruit only for gorillas." And the 800-pound behemoth that he is, he just says, "Well, I guess there's enough fruit up there. I'll quit shaking." Now, I'm a monkey, and I'm looking out into a room full of monkeys. And the last thing you want to do if you find yourself as a monkey is to be a weak monkey. And how do you do that? How do you add value to your product? How do you strengthen yourself? And a lot of the people, big oil included, never thought that the little monkeys could develop a economical way of making ethanol, building a plant for $60 million. For a wet mill, it cost $300 million. And while he was sleeping, they built these little ethanol plants, and they continue to build it. But the gorilla has awakened, and you must be careful. Don't find yourself as a weak monkey. And, Clarence, that's the answer to your question. Don't find yourself as a weak monkey in an ethanol plant or as a corn producer or as an elevator or whatever business you're in.
Our panelists will be here at lunchtime if you want to explore this topic further with them. I'm sure they would more than want to talk to you about that. Mary Holmes, Relationship Manager, Agribusiness Solutions in Peoria. Randall Matheny, Treasurer of Lincoln Land Agri-Energy in Palestine, and Raymond Deffenbaugh, President of Big River Resources out of West Burlington, Iowa. Give this panel a hand, please.